if you could be doing something smarter with your money that creates income now? If you're wanting to get ahead financially and enjoy greater freedom of choice, if you want a comfortable retirement and you know you'll have more choices if you can do more with your money now. If you've wondered who else is creating ways to make their money work for them, and you want actionable ideas with honest pros and cons and no fluff, welcome to the Richer Geek Podcast. We're here helping people find creative ways to build wealth and financial freedom. I'm Mike Stoller, and in this podcast, you'll hear from others who are already doing these things and learn how you can too. Hey, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Richer Geek Podcast. Today we have Taylor Loat. He is into multifamily self-storage, and he'll tell you how to do it. He's a real estate investor who teaches others how to invest in real estate. And this is very interesting. We'll get back into it with him without buying themselves another job. And I know that most of our listeners have very stressful jobs. You work a long time. So how you're able to invest without getting yourself into another full-time job. So how you doing, Taylor?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me today. I'm excited to speak with you and your listeners.
Absolutely. So give us always like a little background. You know, who are you? What made you get into this very lucrative, crazy job in real estate?
Sure. So really, at my core, I'm an investor. From the day I started having a little bit of money from the first job that I worked, first I worked at a grocery store, and then I worked at Sears back when Sears existed. And my goal was to turn that into more money. And at the time, my toolkit only included look for a bank account with the highest interest rates that I could. Now, back in the day, that was pre-Great Recession when you could get an okay rate. That's kind of returning today, but for the longest time, it was 0%. Then going from there, you know, I went to college and everything, graduated from college, and got my first big boy job making some big boy money. And of course, wanted to turn it into more. So I read one of these books that's over my shoulder here, The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham. That got me started investing in the stock market, really looking for value and focusing on those areas. But I wanted to be able to create more value in my investments and to take more of an active role. And I didn't know what that was going to look like. And back in the day, around 2011, I think it was in the fall 2011, I was actually driving to my job at the time around 7:30 in the morning, a fall day in central Pennsylvania in Lancaster, driving to a job at the time that I just hated. It was the wrong fit for me. Maybe some of your listeners out there can relate to that, how they're listening to us right now. But I lived in a relatively nice townhome complex at the time. And driving to work, I drove past the office of the townhome complex and just happened to look over my shoulder. And I saw a brand new, at the time, 2011, Audi A8 sitting in the parking lot. And I was driving my old VW Jetta in a career that was never going to lead me to driving an expensive luxury vehicle like that. And a very happy thought occurred to me just totally on accident. And I thought that, you know what? Whoever owns that car owns this townhome complex. And that was the first time, the very first time that I thought and I realized that somebody owns these big apartment and townhome complexes. It's people. Now, it turns out it's typically a lot of people that own these things together, but that was the first time that I realized that people own all of these assets around us, and that is an achievable goal. So fast forward a few years, you know, digging into more investing, learning more, found out about apartment syndication, ultimately into self-storage syndication as well, where we pool our money to go buy these assets. And it was able to achieve that dream of investing in larger properties like that. I only had that realization somewhat recently because I remembered seeing that car in that parking lot, and I didn't realize how formative and of an experience that was for me at the time, setting me in a particular trajectory to begin investing in real estate. But, you know, little things like that can set you in a different direction than you thought.
Yeah. And that is so true. I don't know if you're the same way, but I didn't get into the syndication for a while because I didn't know about it. And I thought, well, I buy something, fix it up, sell it, buy something, fix it up, sell it. And I was like, man, it's going to take me 40 years to make any money if I do it that way. What was your first syndication or your fund experience like? And what kind of lessons did you learn that you can, you know, tell our listeners about? Wow, I wish I would have done something this way instead of this way, and how you've grown as a syndicator because of some of those lessons learned.
Sure, absolutely. So my first lesson or my first experience in the syndication space was actually as a passive investor. I wanted to get into this space on the active side, and I had capital that I had saved up and accumulated and invested. So I looked for opportunities to invest. And this was in 2016. So it was a kind of a completely different market from today, but ended up investing in two C-class apartment complexes on the south side of Atlanta. And there were so many lessons learned out of that. One of the biggest ones was, to make a very long story short, basically the property manager wound up stealing some money from us. And that turned into a pretty extensive legal battle. And the way that he was kind of able to sort of get away with it, we got some of the money back, it's murky, is that the property manager had ownership in the syndication. He was one of the general partners. So that kind of gave him, in my mind, a sense of entitlement and feeling that he couldn't be fired. And I've seen that structure backfire for a lot of folks where they go find a property manager mm-hmm. and they say, hey, I want to incentivize this guy to perform as best I can. So even though he's a different company, I'll give him some GP shares so that if he performs, he's going to be compensated for it. But from what I've seen, that actually makes it more likely to backfire because, again, they feel like they can't be fired. So if it's a third-party property manager, they need to be third-party. You need to be able to fire them. Or if you're in a situation where a syndicator owns their own property management firm, then in that case, they can fire individuals who misbehave. But that kind of quasi-third-party, they're a different company, but they get GP shares, it just muddies the waters too much. Again, in my experience and my observation speaking with other investors in this space, leads property managers to think they can't get fired for underperformance. So not a good look. It was a big lesson learned in that experience.
Yeah, you know, property management is just, I think, the stickler of every asset class. I agree. It does have to be performance-based. I don't like the flat fees. And then you also have to look at all the little fine lines about how they get paid and when they get paid. And it's just, oh, it's so crazy. But yeah, I've got tales about property manager groups. That's why I went into hotels, everyone. I'm just kidding. Because you have property management also in hotels and you have to watch. It's just a whole different business type of thing. So what are you doing now? You still doing multifamily or are you doing other asset classes?
We do multifamily and self-storage primarily. Now, things have shifted. So as I mentioned, pre-COVID, I started investing in C-class multifamily and did that for a few years, not just those first two, but did a few more after that. And there are some very good reasons, in my experience, not to buy older C-class properties. What we found is that for those older properties, there are more skeletons in the closet. There are going to be more capital expenditure needs in the property that you can look for and account for on the front end, but just the reality of owning properties built in the 60s, 70s, or earlier is that things are going to pop up that despite your best efforts and intentions, you didn't see coming. And oftentimes the bill is much higher than you would think or are prepared for. And so many of those bills don't add to your NOI at the end of the day, your net operating income, which at the end of the day, your goal is to raise the net operating income. So shifting from my investment model and experience, shifting from C-class to B-class built in the 1980s or earlier has been a very important move. You can make a good argument for A-class multifamily as well, but really I think one thing that not enough folks in the space were talking about, or maybe still are talking about, if you will, aren't talking about enough, is just the age of the property. I would not buy anything built in the 60s and 70s or earlier anymore unless you really, really, really know what you're doing. Oftentimes, folks do that because the place just looks so cheap. But in reality, the bills on the back end are the problem.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know I'm thinking this, and probably a lot of maybe the listeners, how do you justify, like, maybe where you're buying these, the cap rates are different, but the interest rates, it seems like they're above the cap rates, especially in my area where they're around 4-4.5%. Interest rates are almost double that, maybe 6 or 7. How do you look at, because back in the day, it was 8-10 cap, 3-4% interest, just buy them all day long. What's your focus now on looking at something, making sure that you're not getting to a speculative type of deal?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's the reason that we've seen a very steep decline in the volume of multifamily transactions in 2023. One of the more recent pieces of data that I saw is that multifamily transactions are down by something like 75%. And buyers and sellers are having a hard time coming to term because sellers still have those, you know, 2021, early 2022 price expectations, and they're not selling unless they really have to. Now, I can't necessarily get into specifics, but we've had opportunities where sellers are selling because they need to. They can't make their debt payments, so we're able to get a very attractive basis, if you will. And in some cases, just speaking more broadly, folks who have had to sell today sometimes are getting their entire equity wiped out from where they purchased in 2021 or 2022. And yeah, that's unfortunate. I certainly don't hope for anybody else to lose money in a deal. That's just kind of the nature of the game today. But again, going back to your point about cap rates versus interest rates, we see that in the volume of transactions. Things are just way down from where they were, and maybe it'll recover into the future. Some folks are talking about, hey, maybe rates will come down next year. I'm not banking that my strategy on that because I see that as kind of hope, and hope is not a strategy. But I think we will see some leveling out of the commercial real estate market into the future. I just don't know what it's going to look like. I speak with a lot of office owners, investors, and property managers on my podcast. I just want to speak about distress and multifamily. From what I've seen, the office market is so much worse. There are huge vacancy problems, you know, prices that are a half or less of what they were in within COVID and even pre-COVID, things are selling for today. So the bloodbath that I see happening is really in office, in commercial real estate right now. But there are struggling operators in multifamily. It's true.
Yeah, I think I just saw an article today in the Wall Street Journal where, I don't know, if, I think it was Florida, I thought, but they're saying that they can't get loans. They're not giving any office loans, none. And there are people that are trying to refinance, or their 5-year or 7-year loans are come up. And they're just like, nope, not doing it. So we're going to see a lot of opportunity, perhaps. But I don't know who would buy it just because of the hybrid work model. And we just don't need those big ones unless you can convert the asset into something.
Yeah, somewhat paradoxically, that is the conversion adaptive reuse model of offices is almost non-viable. From, again, speaking with folks who have really dug into this, who are experts in the office space and have looked at adaptive reuse, the costs to just put in the plumbing that you need to turn an office into, say, an apartment complex just completely blows the model out. And there's so much more that goes into adaptive reuse of an office building and turning it into apartments. From speaking with office experts, what I understand is that most of the office buildings that could be adaptively reused are either already in that process or kind of have already been done. So unfortunately, it seems like that's not going to be a model that bails us out. And, you know, we have a lot of tech people listening right now who are certainly familiar with WeWork. The collapse of WeWork and, I guess, defaulting on their leases, who knows what that's actually going to look like? That's another huge issue for the office market. And I don't know what's going to happen as a result of that, but they did have a lot of leases that seems like they're not going to get paid. The owners of those properties aren't going to get paid. Maybe blood in the water. I don't know whether there's going to be opportunity out there for someone who sees it. And I don't know what that opportunity is going to look like. But, you know, again, unfortunately, the adaptive reuse model kind of seems like it doesn't work in most cases. I wish it would. Honestly, I would go for it if it did, but it just doesn't.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to give everyone your website, passivewealthstrategy.com. Talk of a little bit of difference if someone hasn't gotten into a syndication before. An LP, what a passive investor. Give us some of the things that the terminology of what they're dealing with when they go to your website, because they're looking at it, it's like, what am I a passive? What's a GP? What's an LP? Give us a little breakdown for those that aren't familiar.
Sure. So LP is a limited partner. It's a passive investor whose participation in a deal is limited to their investment. They're not providing their own labor in the deal. They're not putting up their credit, for example, on the loan. And along with that, their risk in the deal is limited to their investment. So the LPs can't be basically sued by a tenant. That's a big concern for sometimes doctors who invest in single family rentals get concerned about maybe personal liability as a result of their rentals. One of the benefits of syndication is that limited partners' risk is limited to their original investment. Their participation in the deal is also limited to their original investment. GP, general partner, the people who are operating the deal, finding the deal, oftentimes putting up their own credit to qualify for the financing. Really, the people who are doing the work to find and deliver and sell the deal and produce a return for investors. What else? There's two key legal structures that are the most common or exemptions for filing with the SEC that you'll hear, 506B and 506C. 506B is basically a private offering that's not advertised, where an unlimited number of accredited investors can invest and up to 35 non-accredited investors, but the sponsor cannot advertise that deal. They have to have a pre-existing relationship with the investors. 506C is a little bit different in the sense that the general partners can go publicly advertised. So what the government giveth, the government taketh something away. So they can have an unlimited number of accredited investors, but no non-accredited sophisticated investors. Another important consideration there is for 506C deals, the sponsor is required to obtain third-party verification of investors' accreditation status. That's something that sponsors pay for. It's just kind of another hoop, if you will, that folks have to jump through. But the government says, yes, you can advertise, but you also need to really make sure that these people are accredited investors and not just basically saying so by having a third party weigh in on that. What else? Are there any other key terms we could touch on? Accredited is a big one. Their net worth or income requirements. A lot of tech folks do qualify either based on income or their net worth. You know, what else? Anything else we want to?
Do you usually do a preferred return or based on IRR, or do you just do a split?
That's a great question. So, yeah, our deals typically will have a preferred return and then a split on the back end. It's important to note what a preferred return is. Preferred return is essentially the position that we each stand in line, if you will, on distributions of, again, returns from the deal. So if the limited partners, the passive investors, are entitled to a, say, 7% preferred return in any given deal, they stand in line first before the general partners to receive a return up to 7% of their investment on an annual basis. And then above that, there's typically a split of whatever the cash flow on the investment is. All deals are different. All operators are different how they do that split above the preferred return. And then on the back end, there's typically a return. Again, all sponsors are different. The most common splits that I see in the industry, speaking, you know, objectively, if you will, is either 70-30, 70% for the limited partners and 30% for the general partners, or 80-20. So those are the most common, but the limited partners should eat first and get a bigger piece of the pie. They should receive a preferential position because they are essentially taking the most risk by investing the money and giving up control.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Very good. And everybody, it is passivewealthstrategy.com. So we talked about multifamily a little bit. Self-storage. Give us a little details on what you're doing in that space.
Yeah, so the self-storage space is really interesting. And we were talking about this a bit before we started recording, but people really like their stuff. And it's not just people, it's also businesses, and that stuff needs to be put somewhere. Sometimes, you know, obviously people keep it at home, but when they're moving, relocating, upsizing, or downsizing their lifestyles, depending on how they're moving, they tend to use self-storage facilities to keep their stuff in. One of the biggest things that I like about self-storage is that it's a lien law based agreement with the renter of the property rather than a landlord tenant law. So it was a big concern of a lot of folks through COVID. The first couple of years of COVID, there were so many eviction moratoriums and everything, depending on where you were. Some were worse or better than others, but self-storage didn't deal with that because it's just stuff. So you're not dealing with landlord tenant law. Now, that's not to say that you can always immediately just go cut the lock off and change it and sell it on Storage Wars or whatever. Every state has different rules about how long the waiting period is and everything like that. But either way, it's nowhere near as onerous in a legal sense as an eviction with an apartment or what have you. Self-storage, I think a big value play, if you will, in the self-storage space these days, and I think probably for the next few years, is that so much of the industry, so much of the product out there is owned by mom and pops, older folks who have owned the facilities for a long time, and they see the facilities as essentially their retirement plan. So they see it as a source of income, but they get more tired, or sometimes they pass away and look to pass on the asset to their kids, who most of the time don't really want it. So our opportunity is to acquire those facilities and bring them up to the market. Those mom and pops don't tend to push rents because they tend to prioritize 100% physical occupancy, just getting people in the places and collect rent in cash or checks or what have you. But our goal should be to acquire those facilities, modernize the operations, normalize the rents. Of course, a lot of times that comes with fixing up the interiors or exteriors, repainting the buildings, and of course, expanding and adding more square footage. Now, self-storage is not immune to the capital markets. The increasing debt service costs have also slowed down the self-storage industry, because when you're, say, adding square footage, that's typically bank financed. And when your interest rate is significantly higher now than it was, say, 2 years ago, it makes it a lot harder to pencil that deal. Also factoring in that construction costs are significantly higher now than they used to be. So what I'm seeing now, and what I expect we'll see at least until interest rates start to fall, whenever that is a reduction in the addition of square footage of self-storage in different markets, whether that's new facilities going up or existing facilities expanding. We're just going to see that slow down. And that's the nature of interest rates going up. So higher rates have made commercial real estate across the board, frankly, harder to do. And I think that's going to wash people out. We still do see opportunities, but the reality is it's just a bit more difficult to find a good, compelling opportunity now than it used to be. But that's why they raise interest rates, right? And that will change eventually. We just don't know exactly when that'll be.
Yeah, it's probably a good thing, or maybe most of the time it's a good thing that we're coming into an election year. So everyone wants to posture. Everyone wants to say, oh, look what I've done to the economy. And a lot of times rates tend to go down or stabilize. I don't think that the credit administration will raise them just because it just looks bad. You know, we're seeing some positive trends in the economy right now with inflation. So I think at least it'll stay the same. And then I've read a lot of economists in the Wall Street Journal. They're saying that they think next year it'll start coming down. So we can all hope for that. So how can people find you? You know, we've been talking a little bit about self-storage, multifamily, passive investing. Do you have something open now, or are you getting ready to open a syndication or a fund?
So for compliance reasons, if I had a deal, I wouldn't be able to talk about it on your show. But If anybody wants to talk, certainly welcome to look me up. But I do have something free I can give to your audience that may be beneficial to them, if I may.
Absolutely. And is it on the website?
Yeah. So you can go to passiverealestatecourse.com. That'll take you directly to my free 7-day video course on red flags in passive real estate investing. There are 7 relatively short videos that I tried to make bite size, talking about 7 different red flags in passive real estate investing. And I hope that's, you know, useful for your listeners, pointing out 7 things that I've seen go wrong in deals more commonly, or oftentimes 7 little blind spots that many new passive investors have, because, you know, when you're new, you don't exactly know what expectations you should have in many cases. So this is hopefully, you know, going to help set expectations and give you 7 things to look out for and to consider if you look into investing in real estate passively.
And everybody, will put that in our show notes. It's passiverealestatecourse.com. 7 red flags in passive real estate investing with a free video course. Taylor, it's been, well, before we end, where can people find you? I'm sure LinkedIn, your website, anywhere else.
So I'm Taylor the Investor on Instagram, underscores between the words. If you want to speak about investing, go to investwithtaylor.com. Or again, check out the video course and you'll get emails from me as well. And you can just, you know, get to me through those emails. Email is probably the best way.
Very good. Taylor, any closing thoughts that you'd like to tell our listeners?
I would say, you know, we talked about interest rates and what might happen over the next year and everything like that. What's happened over the past year and everything like that. But personally, I see real estate, it's a long-term wealth creation vehicle. We should pay attention to the shorter term, you know, 1-year macro moves, things that are happening. But I believe we should have a 5, 10, even 20-year vision of where our investments are going to be taking us. So keep the long term in mind when you're looking at short term changes in the market.
Yeah. And I can't say that any better, because listen, people, if you're always waiting for the interest rates to come down, for instance, I think it was like in 1972, if you bought a house and you waited for, said, well, I need the rates to come down, or need the rates to come down. They didn't go down until the early 90s. But what did happen is that asset probably increased its appreciation 4-fold. So as long as you cash flow, as long as it somehow pencils, what we always say is you marry the asset, but date the rate. Because you can always at some point change the rate, but you can't always get a hold of that asset because it's going to appreciate, but the rates will fluctuate. So don't let that be, oh, I'm not going to invest with Taylor because the rates are high. Yeah, but that asset, Taylor's done his homework, that asset is going to be pretty good. So Taylor, I appreciate you coming on the Richer Geek podcast, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks for tuning in to the Richer Geek podcast, where we're helping others find creative ways to build wealth and financial freedom. For today's show notes, including all the links and resources from our show and more information about our guests, visit us at www.therichergeek.com/podcast. And don't forget to jump over to Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. Share with others who could benefit from listening. And leave a rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. I appreciate you, and thanks for listening.